has written some wonderful things. Those of you who are Don Ciardi fans, you now have to read the most current translation of the Divine Comedy, the best by far. So he writes at all different levels. He's an editor of Touchstone, which I'm just finding out about. It sounds like a wonderful, wonderful magazine, Christian theology, but written for the regular folk. The reason that I found out about Professor Esalen was that he has the latest in the series of the politically incorrect guides. And his is to Western civilization, and it's very, very informative, but it's funny, and it's very pro-natal. And, you know, we're used to pro-life, pro-life, and when you first open, you say, oh, he's going after Anthony Kennedy with the Greeks, that's pro-life. But it's very pro-natal, and it fits in, because, I mean, that's what Western Civ, you know, certainly in the last 2,000 years, what got it, continued its work and everything. So we're so fortunate. Wednesday, he was at the University of Virginia. Thursday, he was at the University of Richmond. Yesterday, he was at Yale, and we have him now. So we welcome Professor Esalen.
This is the child, the little child who as yet could not even speak a word. The Word made flesh, now speechless. The little baby whose sinews were as soft as a baby's sinews, soft as flesh. That baby would be the one to conquer all the might of Rome, and more than Rome, as Christians believe, all the powers and principalities of evil. There it is, the baby. We have no idea, because we've grown up with this, we're used to it, just what kind of revolution that brought about in the history of the world. A baby is the central figure in this great novel. That's new. That's a new thing in the world. I contrast that with another scene involving children. Okay? I want you to imagine that it's the late 3rd century BC, and you are in the city of Carthage. And you have always had, a fertility rite. You worship a god called Moloch. Mentioned in the Bible, right? Some of the kings of Judah and Israel, kind of covering their bases. You want to make sure that you get in your worship of all the gods, just make double sure, had shrines of Moloch set up. The idea behind the fertility rite is that it's a hard, practical, economic arrangement. You would like bumper crops at harvest time. You would perhaps like decent families. But in order to get that out of generally hostile, unwilling gods, you've got to give of your own fertility. So fertility rites involve human sacrifice. Especially during tough times, late 3rd century BC, very late, the Carthaginians had been trying to take over the whole Mediterranean shooting match in their war against Rome. That's why they sent Hannibal and his legions over the Alps to harass the Italians up and down the peninsula. Rome did not fall. In the meantime, our great young general Scipio had taken his troops from Spain across the sea to North Africa, and Carthage was going to be under siege. Had to recall Hannibal to come back. It was the only battle that Hannibal ever lost. But while that was going on, the Carthaginians were frantic. And they cranked up the sacrifices to Moloch in a big way. You have to imagine kind of a furnace with a statue in front of it with a large gaping mouth. You can actually find a picture online of this sort of thing, what it was. The idea was that you would make a little baby, as the euphemism is in scripture, pass through the fire to Moloch, right? Going into the mouth of Moloch to be burnt to a cinder in time. I've been told that in some places what you have fire in front, and Moloch's arms would be like this, but the hands would be tipped down. So you'd place the baby on the hand, and eventually the baby would drop into the fire. Now, the only way you could possibly do this and retain your sanity was if you got yourself high on drugs, or you bought the children of slaves to adopt them so they would be officially your own. And then you would sacrifice them, and then you would get the economic credit. Okay. This is John Milton's description of it, of Moloch in Paradise Lost. Moloch, horrid king, besmeared with blood of human sacrifice and parents' tears, though for the noise of drums and timbrels loud, their children's cries unheard that passed through fire to his grim idol. So you play the tambourines and make a whole lot of noise, cultural noise, so that you don't hear the cries. Okay. Now, their excuse was superstition in sometimes scarcity, famine, or in time of great national distress. What's our excuse? What they did for those darkened reasons, we do for convenience. It seems to me that when revert to paganism. You do not revert to the old paganism simply, the one that was groaning and waiting for the revelation of the Christ child. Having had the Christ child already, and having been taught what it is that children are, then to revert to paganism, you don't revert even to the nasty paganism of the Carthaginians, or the milder and nobler paganisms of Greece and Rome, but to something more debased. More debased still. As I'm thinking about both stories here, it seems to me that we in our country have sentimentalized and reduced both sides. We turned children, our own and the Christ child, into something sweet and pretty and sentimental when that child comes to conquer the world. And we've turned the Moloch decision, which in the old days was dreadful, but you did it knowing that it was a dreadful economic arrangement because of the terrible gods that happened to be ruling over you. We sentimentalized that too. So what are the effects upon us? And I want to suggest to you tonight that there are four. Okay. The first effect: we have become the kinds of people who do not like children. I want to say that again. We have become the kinds of people that do not like children. Do you remember when you were growing up, back in the day when there were these things called children, and they ran around in what used to be called yards and streets, and they engaged in an activity called play, right? That there were all kinds of people on the street, married people, young people, old people, and you knew very quickly that most of them would like you because you were a child, but some would not. I'm thinking of one right now. I'm thinking of the grandmother across the street from where I grew up, who used to tell her own grandchildren not to play in their yard. She lived with her grandchildren in the same house. She used to tell them not to play in their yard because they were making too much noise, she'd have a headache, she'd go play in my grandmother. She didn't even like her own grandchildren. We become that kind of people. Books are written about this. What a stupid thing it is to have a child. How blessed it is not to have to worry about kids. Why do I say we do not like children? We have few. Look, if you really do like children, you have them. And if you can, you have quite a few of them. All right? You like them. You like their company. You like their ways. You find them somehow to brighten your life. You enjoy them, as some people enjoy dogs. If you like dogs, you have dogs. We have very few, and what this does to our children, people, I think, have only begun to examine now. Consider. I wrote an article about this for Touchstone magazine a couple of summers ago. I grew up in an Italian family, okay? My father was one of 10 surviving children, my mother one of 6. I had 39 first cousins, okay? A majority of those first cousins lived either in my town or within a short driving distance. I saw them constantly. And I was a very shy first, painfully shy boy, and yet cousins were ready-made for me. You don't have to worry about what your cousin thinks of you. Your cousin's your cousin. You can just waltz into your cousin's house, it doesn't matter, and get a drink of orange juice or use the bathroom. The cousins have to pick you for the baseball team, whether they think you can play first base or not, because it's your cousin. They might not pick you first, but they got to pick you eventually. My wife, who is not Italian, but of German and Dutch, English, ancestry. Her father was one of 4 surviving children, and her mother one of 13 survived. Right. She had 42 first cousins. My son and daughter have 3, and 2 of them we are not close to. We are raising the first generation in the history of the world who whose young people do not know what it means to have kinfolk, all right, to enjoy the kind of teasing love of an uncle, the kind of motherly care of an aunt, that she isn't your mother, but she can kind of act like your mother, right? They won't know this. They live far away. There are very few in any case. We have set them up for an emotionally starved existence. It is in part a lonely existence. It's the first time in the history of the world. Why? We don't like them that much. We like them. We have some more maybe. The ones we do have, we keep them out of sight. Now, so a woman, a sociologist named Jane Jacobs, and she is not a conservative. She's still alive. She's 90 years old. She's a Canadian. She's kind of an old-fashioned liberal. She wrote in the late 50s that everybody was making a dreadful mistake when it came to urban planning, especially in the establishment of playgrounds and zoning businesses away from where people lived. Her point was that it was children that united the community. Okay? Children who would be near places of work, would themselves patronize businesses, would be all over the streets, all right, as the eyes and ears of the community, and also as those creatures that, well, and responsible adults would look out for too, right? Not just cordoned off into some playground. Everything that she said back then in the death of the great American city is true now, and true now in spades, right? You have children, you've got to get them away from what is done by adults at most times, most places, right? Keep them out of sight. And this goes along with this other thing that we have done to them. We've denied them a natural life. I do not think that anybody my age older says to himself, my gosh, wouldn't it have been wonderful when I was growing up to have ridden that yellow school bus for 45 to 90 minutes in the morning and then again in the afternoon to take up my entire day, especially in the winter, so that it would already be dark by the time I got home. Wouldn't that have been just great? And when I was at school, wouldn't it have been just so wonderful to have swelled the school day with inanities so as to provide only 20 minutes for lunch? To gobble food down like oil for a machine in a factory, right? And not to lose any efficiency, you only give a little bit of time for rest to recharge batteries so that you can begin the grind again. Wouldn't it have been great to force down a lunch over 10 minutes and then have 10 minutes to use the bathroom, to breathe, and then to go back to learning inanities? Nobody would say that. We would all have found it horrible, and we do it to our children. And that says a great deal about what we really think of them, I think. We deny them a natural life. Robert Frost, the last truly popular poet in the United States. Frost was a farmer. Frost grew up on a farm. When mom and dad moved from San Francisco to New Hampshire, they bought a farm, and that's where that kid worked. Now, if you're a farm kid, you work. So there's no, this is no sentimental kid's life that we're talking about here. That boy worked hard every day of his life. There were chores to be done on the farm, and the chores are not easy. And yet, Frost could not have been Robert Frost writing the poetry that he did if he did not have a life. If he wasn't able to go outside, to play, to go into the woods alone, to enjoy solitude, enjoy playing with others. We see it all over his poetry. First book of poetry he ever writes is called A Boy's Will. Published it when he's around 40 years old. He writes to us poems in which he reminisces about what it's like to grab hold of the top branches of a thin and flexible birch tree, in the poem called Birches, and climb on up them and swing on the birch as the recoil sends you up and down. Simple and silly activity. All right? We wouldn't allow it now. We wouldn't allow it because we've got some deep suspicion about that sort of thing anyhow. And maybe a guilty conscience. We overprotect, perhaps, and it's not good for the kids, the few kids we managed to have. What? Frost swinging on birches without a helmet? In the same vein, how many people here can remember the last time they drove past a vacant lot that was not vacant but had children on it playing baseball? That's right, we used to do it all the time. What I grew up doing in a neighbor's backyard, old folks, what I grew up doing every day of the summer, or almost every day when it was raining, we played chess on my cousin's back porch. Sometimes we played croquet. We went up the woods. We played in abandoned mines. We did things. You know, somebody would leave their dead refrigerator at the side of a strip mine, and we would go over and push it in. That's what you're supposed to do, you know? And nobody ever did much. I haven't seen it in years. I can't remember what's happened. Once in a while, I'll pass by a touch football. I have not passed by a bunch of kids playing baseball in at least the last 15 years. The national pastime. So we deny them a natural life. We really do. Can't happen. And we corrupt their souls. Now, this is still point number one. We don't like children. There's a story that St. Augustine tells in the Confessions about his very innocent and charming young friend, Alypius. Right? They're in Italy. Augustine's in Italy by this time. And Alypius is one of those young people that almost no longer exists. We almost have to exercise our imaginations. It requires a leap of imagination to believe that such a person could really exist. He's a young man with a pure heart. Okay? We don't know that such people exist anymore, but Alypius was one. You can imagine a young man in his 20s. He's never known a woman, right? In the old sense. And he's kindly and noble and a little bit shy. And some of his pals want to take him to that great pornographic spectacle in Rome, or maybe they were in Milan by this time, doesn't matter, called gladiatorial games, where you could enjoy the dreadful horror of watching human life be dispensed with before your very eyes. And Alypius didn't want to go. But they nagged him and nagged him. Maybe they called him a sissy. I don't know what they did. He finally agreed to go, but he said he would not look. So there he was sitting, not looking. And all at once, with the man down, okay? Well, what happened? I don't know if you know what happens, but in the gladiatorial games, when the man was down and clearly beaten, he would ask the crowd like this for mercy, all right? And the crowd would either grant him the mercy, and the sign was thumbs up, or deny him the mercy, and the sign was thumbs down, and they would cry out, "Jugula, jugula," which means, roughly, give it to him in the throat. All right? And a roar went up at just this moment. The crowd gave the thumbs down signal, or the leader, whoever was there in attendance, the emperor, emperor's son, whatever. And Alypius looked. And he saw this carnage. He was attacked by lust of the eyes. And he was hooked. And for the next 2 years or so, he was a fanatic of the games. It had entered his soul. It had corrupted him. It required the grace of God to free him from that bondage. All right? And Alypius eventually, with Augustine, in fact, they were baptized together, became a Christian. And like Augustine, Alypius became a bishop of the Catholic Church. Dustin's best friend. That happened to him on one day. And our children are daily exposed to filth that's so bad, so deadening to the soul, so inhuman and stupid, that it makes of so many of them before they're even 20 years old as cynical as people who are 50 and have been twice divorced. Not believing in human beauty, not believing in the wonders of the opposite sex, not believing in marriage except as some arrangement that might redound to your personal satisfaction if you're lucky. Cynical, hard, flattened souls. We do it to them. If we really liked children, we would not. Okay? We don't. Look, what's at the grocery store? I mean, forget about the shops where, you know, you would not dare be seen. Look at the grocery store or the drugstore. We corrupt their souls. In fact, it is the stated purpose of certain programs in the schools to do just that. To remove from them any silly sentimental notion that there is such a virtue as purity. Right? Gone. That's bad enough. Bad enough to end up being all like the old crabs in my neighborhood, the one or two, who don't really like children. Manage to have a few for our own purposes and make their lives miserable as we use them to satisfy our vanity. Okay? Bad. That's bad. It's worse. There's a second effect that this has on us. This one it's a little harder to see. It uproots us from time, from the generations. You see, people who love children love those beings whose life will go on into the future after we have died. And you will notice that people who love children like to tell those children stories about when they were children and what their old man did to them when they started the car when they were 9 years old and weren't supposed to. And so what you have with child-rich families is also a not just a living in time in the few years where we happen to be on Earth, but living that time under a kind of shadow of generations past and generations to come, almost living in time as if it were eternity. We don't have that. Maybe that's what makes us really antsy about how many years we're going to live. Because if you live 50 years under the shadow of eternity, you lead a rich life. But if you're not living under the shadow of eternity, if you have cut yourself free from generations past and generations to come, well, then your few days on earth are all you have. And then it becomes absolutely essential to do anything at all, any means, to lengthen out that life. You'll never be satisfied, anyway. We lead a thin life. We forget our forebears because we know we are going to be forgotten by our descendants in turn. What kind of people are like that? I ask you to consider with me a love poem from the English Renaissance. Okay? Now, this is not a Catholic love poem. This is a Protestant English love poem. Its view of what marriage is all about and the marital act, the act of love between husband and wife, is so strange to us now that you would think it would have only have been expressed by some raving Catholic straight from Rome. In his wedding poem called Epithalamion, which means wedding poem, poet Edmund Spenser has 24 stanzas, one corresponding to each hour of the day. When he gets to stanza 16, sort of in the middle of 16, 17, there's a sudden shift in the poem because he's been inviting the whole world to his wedding. The nymphs, boys and girls of the town, everybody, the fishes, the birds, all of creation welcome to his wedding. And he asks them all to sing and to help him to celebrate the day, to light bonfires. Boys are running up and down the street. And then at this one moment, he turns around and says, "No, you know, the day's done." And he begins to dismiss them because night has fallen. And now is time for love, for the act of love, which is a holy act. And towards the very end of the poem, he is in bed with his wife, and he calls upon the influence of the gods. This is a literary device. He is praying for the influence of the heavens to be shed upon him and his wife as they become one flesh, so that they can raise up posterity after them to increase the number of the blessed saints above. The act there, which is so quiet and seemingly private, is not private at all. It involves the whole cosmos. It involves all the people who came before us and people to come whom we will never know. It involves the saints in heaven, the communion of saints looking down upon them, and the blessed angels and God himself. All right? We have no sense of that. Nobody talks like that. Now, love is reduced to an appetite. It's not some participation in a grand and providential plan spanning the ages from the dawn of man's creation to the end. It's my appetite. What I want, here and now. The people for whom love has been reduced to appetite are people in dire straits. People who can just barely be characterized as human at all. Since we have cut ourselves off from past and future, we no longer honor the dead. Think of this. And think of how what a kind of paltry existence has left us. How many people here remember that day at the end of May when there used to be parades in every little town? And people used to go to tombs to decorate them for their relatives. Do you remember that? It used to be called Memorial Day. I call it Oblivion Day. My town in Pennsylvania had a parade every Memorial Day. It was one of the finest days of the year for me as a little boy. That parade, and we were just a podunk little town here. We had no business getting up a parade, but we got up a parade. That parade would go early in the morning to the Protestant cemetery above where I live. And there they would shoot 21-gun salute, and somebody would play taps. And the men would be in full uniform, and it was a solemn time. And then we'd go down from that hill, and we boys would climb on the fire trucks. Because they liked children back in those days. And we would ride those fire trucks without a helmet, without any seatbelt. We'd jump on them. And we rode through the town. It would snake its way through town and end up at the Catholic cemetery on the mountain opposite. And there we'd all head off, and there would be mass at the cemetery. And then the parade would resume and take its way all the way down to the American Legion, where there were donuts and orange juice for us kids. And as for the guys in the uniform with the bulging bellies and the rifles, probably something other than orange juice inside. My town has not had a Memorial Day parade in over 30 years. And I dare say most towns have forgotten what that is either. We think of ourselves as owing no duty to those who came before us. We reject what Chesterton called the democracy of the dead, which is honoring tradition, honoring and in gratitude those who gave us so much, to remember them. We don't do it. And we assume that we will not be remembered in turn and live our lives accordingly. It's a thin life. Third thing that it does to us. It makes us fearful. We pride ourselves wrongly on our independence, on our ability to live alone. Apparently, for the first time in the history of mankind, certainly in the history of America, a majority of households have one person in it, right? Or at least single people, not married. We live alone. And we say we're independent. Don't believe it for a moment. We are terrified of our fragility. People in previous generations who lived not nearly as long as we do spent nowhere near the time we spend worrying about the day that comes to all, the day that we will die. We are terrified. We live alone. We think we're strong, and yet we're ridiculously needy. And the last thing that a person who is terrified of age and decay, the things that happen to your body, whether you like them or not, the last thing that that person wants is a child around to remind us of our weakness and to destroy our illusions of choice. I like to say to people sometimes that that organization called Planned Parenthood has a title that's deeply deceptive, but in more than one way. I mean, everybody knows that Planned Parenthood is not about the business of planning parenthood. Planned Parenthood is about the business of making sure that people don't become parents, either by making sure they don't become pregnant in the first place or by snuffing out the offspring if it should happen that they do become pregnant. But there's something more sinister about it all even than that. If you have to plan your parenthood, there is already something wrong. You are already desperately trying to control the things in your life that we never really would be able to control anyway. You are already deeply insecure if you need planning. The best things in life are those things often which are spoiled precisely to the extent that we choose them. Okay? But we weaklings want to live with this illusion of limitless choice. But think of it. If you plan an adventure, you are not on an adventure. Okay? If you seek out joy, if you think that you can engineer it, you are going to be disappointed, and you don't even know what joy is. All right? To the extent that you plan your child, you are not planning a child at all. You're planning an egotistical extension of yourself. A child should come like a surprise. Yes, sir?
Joy. Jesus, others, you. Joy.
It should come in that order, eh?
Right.
Yeah. But we worship now a different trinity, you understand? Me, myself, and I. Right? The child destroys our illusion of choice and reminds us of our weakness. This has really got to be emphasized. I mean, we got to be honest about this. People are afraid of children because they think that children will destroy their lives. Right? They are absolutely right. Children will destroy their lives. That's why God gave us them. Because otherwise, our lives are like little hard kernels of selfishness, kernels of egotism. And it's really hard to break through that shell. But God sends children down the chimney, perhaps, as invaders, precisely to do that, to break open that hardest substance in the universe, the human heart. The child comes to destroy our dead lives and give us a hope, anyway, of life and life in abundance. This is what Christ's child is all about. I recall with just astonishment, puzzlement, a recent statement by a political candidate to the effect that if his daughter became pregnant out of wedlock, he would not want her to be punished with a baby. It says it all. And I don't mean to blame that candidate for this over much, because that's the attitude that everybody has, right? For white people implicitly have that attitude when they think that somebody who would bear such a child's term would be really heroic. No, not really heroic, but only doing what is absolutely natural and right to do, okay? And that child would not be, is best not thought of as a sacrifice to, you know, you're, I mean, giving up some of my selfish ways here, and graciously bestowing them on that child. That child comes to ruin everything, thank God. I'll give you an example of this from literature. Okay, this is from a book by George Eliot called Silas Marner. And George Eliot was no conservative. She was a liberal. She was a radical. But radicals back in those days were different, okay? And they might still love children. Silas, wrongly accused of the crime of theft, has turned in on himself and lived a hard, cold life of amassing wealth for its own sake. He doesn't even use it, all right? He's a good man, but it's buried beneath a shell of self-protectiveness and, shall I say, choice, okay? Buried there. And one night, a dying woman who's been ill-used by one of the sons of the aristocracy, a dying woman with a little baby, stumbles near his cottage. The cottage of a man who is alone in the world. She dies, and he takes up the little baby girl. He insists, against the wishes of the townspeople, that he will keep that baby girl. What the baby does to him, the baby does, is to ruin his life, to break down those walls. The baby's arms are strong, as strong as battering rams, those weak little arms. So I read here. The gold, that is the gold that he scrambled up, it was his choice, had asked that he should sit weaving longer and longer, deafened and blinded more and more to all things, except the monotony of his loom and the repetition of his web, we might substitute, flying on ventures for our corporation, or whatever it may be that we happen to do to fulfill these inanities which we sometimes call our dreams. Okay, whatever it may happen to be, whatever vanity, all right? But Epi, the little girl, now a toddler, called him away from his weaving and made him think all its pauses a holiday, reawakening his senses with her fresh life, even to the old winter flies that came crawling forth in the early spring sunshine and warming him into joy because she had joy. Later on, as the child's mind was growing into knowledge, his mind was growing into memory. As her life unfolded, his soul, long stupefied in a cold, narrow prison, was unfolding too, and trembling gradually into full consciousness. This is what the child has come to do. We won't let children do that to us, because we keep them out of the way. Instead of believing that the children are those beings we love for whom we work, we now think of them at best as pleasant, maybe funny, interruptions in our work. If we think of them that way, we've already shut them apart from the effects that God has intended they should have upon us. Here's a book that you might know a little bit better. A man named Scrooge is visited by some spirits, including the spirit of Christmas yet to come. And he begs the spirit to show him some tender feeling on this Christmas. And the spirit leads him to the house of Bob Cratchit. Bob Cratchit, as we find out as the scene goes on, has in the meantime lost his crippled little child, Tim, Tiny Tim. When Scrooge and the spirit enter this little house, a house rich with children and rich with what life is all about, not rich in money, not rich in prestige or name, whatever. The children are around one of the older children, Peter, who is reading them. Peter had a book before him. The mother and her daughters were engaged in sewing. Surely they were very quiet. And Peter read. And he took a child and set him in the midst of them. Let's read the scripture. You know what the next words are. Suffer the little children to come unto me, Do not hinder them, for of such is the kingdom of heaven. And I tell you that unless you become as a little child, you shall not enter the kingdom of heaven. Scrooge will eventually see that the crutch is set aside in the corner of the room, lovingly, as a memorial for this son and brother that they all love. Bob comes into the room, and he apparently has not the spring in his step that he used to have back in the day when he carried Tim on his shoulders and spring in his step. Now there is no Tim on his shoulders, and he walks more slowly. He comes in, and he apparently has visited the grave. Says, "I wish you could have gone, my dear. It would have done you good to see how green a place it is. But you'll see it often. I promised him that I would walk there on a Sunday." "My little child," cried Bobby. "My little child." And he breaks down. Scrooge is watching. Scrooge, throughout all of this, has not made a single comment. That child has come into the world, in Dickens' scheme of things, not to burst down the hard hearts of the Cratchit family. They are already a family of love. They already have a fully human life, though they don't have much money. That child has come into the world precisely to break down the heart of Ebenezer Scrooge. This that gets him. More than anything else, more than the fear of his own death, more all of the horrible things that he has seen and the sweet things he has seen from his past, things that he has lost, more than all of that, it's this child playing the role of the Christ child here to break down the walls of Scrooge's heart, punished with a child. I could only pray that we would all be so punished, and again and again. The last thing. It renders us incapable of wonder at ourselves, at God, and at the world that he has given us. My wife has a picture of my daughter, our firstborn, only a couple of weeks after she was born. And she's bald. She had a very thoughtful look about her always when she was a little baby. And maybe you've seen this look in children, okay? They grow out of it, unfortunately. But she has her head tilted in her mouth, kind of like this. And the eyes. Have you ever seen those eyes in children? The eyes that seem to be seeing what you cannot even imagine, as if they had come from another world, which they haven't. And what a wondrous thing that is. Okay? Now imagine that you have looked upon this wonder, but you have decided for your own egotistical reasons or political reasons, whatever it may happen to be, that you're not going to see that wonder anymore. For you, as for a certain bioethicist at Princeton University, for you, as for Peter Singer, this is a problem to be managed. Maybe you want to keep it because it serves your purposes in one fashion or another. But maybe after a few weeks, you decide, well, it's proving to be a little bit more trouble than I thought. I exercise my veto option. Let's have it euthanized. Okay? As if it were drowning a puppy. Although I dare say, most people in the United States have a sentimental attachment to puppies and would not do to dogs what they habitually do to human beings. To say something like that, you have to be blind and deaf. You have to have a callus on your soul several feet thick to be incapable of beholding that being with wonder. This is not just a case of blindness and deafness there. It characterizes our entire educational system now. And it really compromises us all. We all have calluses on the soul just from being human, just being prone to sin. But now the calluses are especially thick. Our educational institutions instruct children to believe that their forebears were only, merely, racists and warmongers. That their church, even Catholic schools will do this, that the church in past days was only after its own prestige, its own power. Okay? We teach scorn and flippancy to our young people. We tell them, sometimes explicitly, that to behold something in wonder, to regard it with awe, is to act like a fool. Right? We instruct them to think better of themselves than that. Okay? But the pagan philosopher Aristotle says philosophy begins in wonder. The love of wisdom begins in wonder. Wonder is this strange emotion that we have when we are in the presence of overwhelming beauty. We react to it with awe and gratitude. We do not say, gee, I wonder what I could use that for. You go to a great waterfall, it's astonishing, and you say, my gosh, could I bring that to profit somehow? Or, I wonder, how will this help me up the ladder of corporate success? We would look upon somebody who thought that way as a sort of moral monster, or somebody, a human being that had some organ of humanity missing or crippled. And yet, that's how we instruct our children to be. And we are ourselves that way with regard to the children we allow to live and those children we do not allow to live. Now, let's make no mistake about it. The effect is universal upon the human race, not just upon these people here and there who happen to engage in that sin. We're right now facing the possibility that scientists will create what they call chimeras, you've heard this, amalgamations of human and animal, to be, well, I don't know, maybe regarded with fun by us, or cannibalized for medical or industrial purposes. We may be creating human life for the express purpose of using it industrially or medically. Now, as soon as we do it, instantaneously, in the very act, we will say, we have conquered our own nature, we are now the masters of our nature. But as C.S. Lewis says in a book called The Abolition of Man, which every single pro-life person ought to read once a year, like every Christian of any sort ought to read this book once a year, C.S. Lewis points out that as soon as you engage in that apparent triumph, you have lost everything. Because you have reduced human nature to a product at the end of the assembly line. That's not something that happens down the road in the future. It happens in the very act. As soon as we clone human beings, we have turned ourselves into products at the end of the assembly line. Nobody gapes in wonder at a bottle cap. To engage in it, to even be able to imagine doing something like that is already to be incapable of regarding the human being with wonder. It's to be incapable of understanding these words from Scripture, which I will read to you now and finish with this. Scripture doesn't pull any punches when it comes to human frailty and evil. But Scripture also has this to say. O Lord, our Lord, how excellent is thy name in all the earth, who has set thy glory above the heavens. Out of the mouths of babes and sucklings hast thou ordained strength because of thine enemies, that thou mightst still the enemy and the avenger. When I consider thy heavens, the work of thy fingers, the moon and the stars which thou hast ordained, what is man that thou art mindful of him? Son of man, that thou visitest him. Thou hast made him a little lower than the angels, and hast crowned him with glory and honor, Thou madest him to have dominion over the works of thy hands. Thou hast put all things under his feet, all sheep and oxen, yea, and the beasts of the field, fowl of the air and the fish of the sea, and whatsoever passeth through the paths of the sea. So, Lord our Lord, how excellent is thy name in all the earth. There you have it all. The beauty and the wonder of creation. The beauty and the wonder of babes themselves. The beauty and wonder of man. And the wonder of God who made all of this. The people that allow their own children to be snuffed out for practical purposes. Cannot write that song. And almost can cease to understand the feeling that gave rise to it in the first place. That's what we have to fight. And not just this law or that law. A daunting task. But may God bless you in your attempt to fight that good fight. Thanks.
Cloning, that sort of thing, that's in itself.
In essay, yeah. Yeah. And the other involves prudential judgments that we I think we can argue about with the and different persons will take it.
Yeah. Have we yet cloned human beings? I know we have the sheep, but have we yet cloned humans? I don't think so.
I believe we have.
Has the human race
done so with the embryonic cells?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yes, Becker.
This gentleman brought up a good question because my wife and I are dealing with a situation. A dear friend of ours was conversing with my wife about the election. And my wife was talking about the pro-life. And this person said, well, abortion is just part of the whole pro-life picture. War being a part, you know, pro-life. And she was very much for the president-elect, irregardless of his position on abortion. And to me, it's like she oversimplified, overgeneralized, or made a rational generalization about the pro-life. And if you could expound just a little bit more on that.
Now, I think that some people, not all, but a lot of people who argue like that are arguing in bad faith. Some people are might not be. Okay? You go to a Catholic worker house in Virginia, where a couple of my old friends are, you know, welcoming bankers, and they are vehemently anti-abortion and vehemently pacifistic. Right? Now, I don't think that Christianity requires that vehement pacifism, but I respect it. I don't necessarily respect the general run of people who argue that way. And I want to go up to them sometimes and say, okay, look, you say that I, if I'm to be absolutely consistent, should oppose the death penalty, for instance. Now, I sit on the fence with regard to the death penalty. I don't think it's a civilization breaker, one way or the other. But I'll tell you what, I'll make you a deal. I'll oppose the death penalty. You oppose abortion. And then see what happens. And then all at once, the facade comes down and there's, but they are different issues. Mm-hmm. Oh, yes, well, precisely, they are different issues. I don't want to talk too much about the election. I don't want to overrate things that are not that important. I shouldn't say that. The election is somewhat important, but there are more important things in life. The Catholic political philosopher Robert George, in the last couple of weeks, dealt with that one, I think, very soundly. And his article is easily available online. It was all over the net. His name is Robert George. He wrote it for the Witherspoon Institute. Man is a genius, and he argues point by point that, in fact, what we have just done, this was before the election, but what we have done now is to elect the most radical pro-abortion president in history. Okay. I only hope that he loses interest in the issue, because I don't see what political advantage he can gain from pressing it. That in fact this sort of talk is a red herring. It's a way to cloud the issue. But if such a person is sincere, then he will say, okay, fine, I will oppose the war. Then I will oppose all wars. I'll call your bluff. Okay. Now you come and protest at the Planned Parenthood clinic with me. I'll go with you on Thursday to carry signs around a recruiting station. You come with me on Friday to protest the abortion. See what happens. I wonder what would happen. I don't know. No. Yes.
Just to be clear, my definition of genius is, and I may not be genius, definition of Jesus, genius. Genius, someone who places into words what everyone already knows. I came up with that.
You came up with that? Virginia? Yes.
We have been fighting this for a very long time. We marched, we raised money, we protest, we encouraged candidates, we've done an awful lot of things. I never thought it would take this long. And I was just thinking as you're talking about how the culture that we live in, how it's affected all of us, how how, because it's so mundane and we hear the word so often and we know about it. I mean, when I was a kid, you wouldn't even say the word.
I know.
I mean, it would just drive you crazy. It would just be a shivering, a quiet, horrible feeling. And I'm thinking, it's so common now. You hear everything. So,
well, a lot of other things too.
So, yeah, right. But why haven't we won yet? Why is this still going on? Are we not passionate enough? I mean, when you think about it, what kind of a culture kills their own children? Because those words are so profound. We should all be shivering about it.
We should be shivering.
But why is it going on and on?
We've gotten used to it. You know, in the history of mankind, there are all kinds of evils that people just sort of shrug their shoulders at. They're used to it. Augustine, when his friend Alypius went to the arena and saw the gladiatorial combat, Augustine himself took that for granted before he became Christian. It was part of the world they lived in. Now, Christianity would eventually wipe out that evil. But think, Augustine is recalling his time as a young man in the 380s. Constantine made Christianity a legal religion in 313. 70 years later, Christianity, Theodosius made it the official religion of 386, I believe. It's going to be the official religion of the empire. There's still going to be gladiatorial combats. We can't underestimate the capacity of the human soul to remain callous to plain evil. We get used to it. Maybe our maybe I don't know why God has allowed this to happen. Maybe one of the things is that we have not fully seen how deeply intertwined this issue is with a whole lot of other things that we fought without deep enough consideration. I was talking to my wife about this on our way up here, that one of the awful things that the Catholic bishops, or some of them, did in the 80s to hamstring the pro-life movement was to tie it to the wrong issues. So that pro-lifers could be embarrassed if, for instance, they did support the death penalty or were, like me, kind of agnostic on the death penalty. Instead, the abortion issue ought to have been tied to those things with which it is immediately related. It is related to men and women and what they are, to marriage and divorce, and to the raising of children. It's related to the whole set of issues regarding human sexuality. Okay, that set is where it belongs. That's what it's tied to. And we've just been routed from the battlefield on all of those others. We would not now be talking, for instance, about what I will call, and I hope not to offend anybody here, but I'm a Catholic, right? I call homosexual pseudogamy. Not marriage. It's not a man and a woman. I call it pseudogamy. We would not now be arguing about it if we had not, without any loud protest from good Catholics, from our bishops, if we had not accepted a no-fault divorce society. It was a dreadful thing to accept. All right? We have accepted, now I know that this is a pro-life organization, this is not a Catholic organization, but I will ask people to reconsider the social effects of the pill. I just reconsider the mantle philosophy, okay? Let's not talk about the morality of it. Leave that aside for the moment. Let's not talk about whether scripture would have us decide the issue one fashion or another. Just consider the anthropological effects of having that thing available, okay? That thing being available now makes possible for everybody to believe that the satisfaction of their individual appetites is the be-all and end-all of existence, and things that get in the way of that, like, for instance, an ornery husband, or a wife who spends too much, or an extra child, things that get in the way of my free exercise of choice, my satisfaction of appetite, ought to be removed from the way, so that I can lead what is called a fulfilled life. That's why we divorce. That's why we also abort. I'd ask everybody to reconsider that. You know, you don't have to buy Pope Paul VI's Humanae Vitae or Pius XI's Casti Connubii. Don't even go there. Be practical and anthropological. My gosh, what did we expect would happen? Okay? So maybe our problem is that it's this whole range of human sexuality, including what men and women are supposed to be for one another, that we've got all wrong. Right? And we've been trying to fight this or that aspect of it, depending on what group you're talking to and who we are, when actually it is all tied together. This is the particular way in which Satan has decided to go after us. He goes after other people, perhaps by making them brutal and cruel. He goes after us by making us self-indulgent and utterly unconcerned with what sex is really all about. That act that unites us to generations past and to come, and in which we are privileged to share in the creative power of God. Yeah, the family. Yeah. Way back there, man.
My question really ties into what you just laid out very carefully. In looking at the timeline of man, certainly we as man have tried to control fertility, putting babies on the roofs, feeding the babies to the gods and so forth. I'm wondering if you could comment on the scope of the battle today as regards birth control pills and how that makes it unique and makes it so expansive and much more cumbersome than prior times. It seems to me this is affecting common man on such a massive scale that the fallout.
It is a new thing in the world. I don't know, one of the weekly magazines from the world below, at the turn of the century, decided to ask a bunch of experts what was the great event of the last 100 years. John Rock, who was a Catholic in the Archdiocese of Boston, I don't know if he's still alive, but Rock, he died. Okay. Rock replied with great pride, okay, that it was in fact the invention of the birth control pill. And you know what? I think he's right. Mm-hmm. Okay. Yes, it does change. If it's made legal and available, it changes everything massively. A thing that had more to do with the overturning of the civilization, by far, than that unpleasantness in mid-century that happened in Germany. As horrific as that was, you could defeat Hitler, pick up the pieces, and either do something wise and make for a democratic Europe, or do something stupid, which would be to adopt some of the policies of the defeated Hitler, or do something kind of in between, which is what Europe ended up doing. But whatever, that was not, as it turned out, to be, that was not a civilization killer. This might be. Maybe it already has been. Okay. There are some social scientists now who are, you know, a few Catholic social scientists, or conservative social scientists, who are beginning to ask the question, just what does this do to people? It is the first time in the human race. Yeah. Oh, sure. People used to try to control their fertility, but they didn't have any way of making sure that it would work. And yes, you could expose a child on the hillside, but in the meantime, everybody knew that you had one, all right? And maybe it was a scandal to your family. There are all kinds of very practical reasons why you at least had to pretend that you were virtuous, even if you were not. And the pills changed all that. Utterly changed the relationship between men and women. I can think of no good that the pill has done. And yet, we live in a world that is characterized by it, even those of us who reject it. All right? The sins against human sexuality are not considered mortal sins. We don't even, those of us who oppose them, don't even take them seriously. Because we figure, oh, well, they're on a pill. Right? That would be matter for a very, very long conversation. I asked the same Professor George a couple of years ago whether he believed that if it could be shown that human community, real human community, and Western civilization particularly, could not survive the pill, whether then it would be not only allowable to outlaw it, but in fact an act of self-defense on the part of the civilization. It would be your duty to outlaw it. And he replied, I really wondered how he would reply, because the man is also a kind of a practical politician. He replied that it would be essential to outlaw it, and that that was in fact the argument in Griswold versus Connecticut, that the argument that lost, that this, if it was allowed, would ruin the society, would destroy things, would destroy marriage, would undermine everything, would undermine community. That was the argument lost. In the late 19th century and early 20th century, that same argument won. And then it was not applied to estrogen pills, but applied to barrier devices. And it was a guy in Connecticut, a guy named Anthony Comstock, that went around the country crusading for just these laws to be passed on the grounds that these devices, if they're made widespread and just sort of accepted in a blasé sort of fashion, that they would ruin the communities, right? They would ruin human community, they'd bring down the civilization, they'd wreck everything. That argument was accepted then, okay? Well, maybe they had a keener appreciation of what a child is for and what a marriage is for. And the Comstock laws were passed all over the place. It was a Comstock law that was being challenged in Griswold versus Connecticut in the 60s. Maybe it'd be an interesting thing for those who might want to pursue this line to go and find material on this man, Anthony Comstock, who was lauded as a kind of hero by conservatives and liberals of the day, back then, all right? And now he's regarded as a lunatic, a fanatic. But that argument's been made, and the argument was accepted. It was no longer accepted. And, you know, what? Now we have entire neighborhoods of cities where you can't even find a father, married, mother, children living. Yes, sir?
In a very simplified term, could you say that we substituted love with lust?
Yeah, you know, if you look at, I don't want to call it popular culture because I don't think it's culture at all, the mass entertainment that's fed to us, okay? And you compare it with the mass entertainment from the 50s that still had a large element of popular local culture to it, you know, like for instance, the much despised Leave It to Beaver show, okay? I don't know what's despicable about Leave It to Beaver. You have a wise father who sometimes makes mistakes, a very kindly mother who's sometimes a little overindulgent, and two dumb kids who are kids, and you enjoy the kids because they're kids. They're not smart alecky, smart mother, anything. There was still an abiding belief in love, right? Family love, and, the wonder of the opposite sex. Wonder that would cause Wally to stammer if he had to go out with a pretty girl, not know what to say. That's gone. And what's replaced it? Not a whole lot of wonder. When was the last time you saw in popular entertainment, mass entertainment, someone portraying a young man or young woman struck with awe by the beauty, I don't mean the skin, but the beauty of someone of the opposite sex? When was the last time?
Napoleon Dynamite.
Napoleon Dynamite.
Somebody mentioned that to me. I've never seen the movie. But if you see, it's very, very rare. Okay? Mainly, if you look at, I watch sports. I otherwise don't watch television. I watch sports, and so look at the commercials. I hate the commercials. I just want to watch football games. But the way the sexes are portrayed on the commercials are as objects of contempt. You know, the women are, you'll excuse me, the women are bitchy and sluttish, and the men are oafish and boorish. That's what they are to one another. Now, the devil Screwtape in C.S. Lewis Screwtape Letters reveals the secret of all of this. See, he says, I'm going to trip on it. He says that the enemy, that's the boss of all, the enemy, he's a hedonist. He actually loves these vermin. He wants them to have abundant life. He wants them to have this thing, we don't know what it is, called joy, right? It must be a fiction. We don't understand it. All our laboratories can't produce it. We're working on it, though. He wants them to have that. Now, our deal, he says to Wormwood, is to bait them with pleasure. But understand that pleasure is always on the enemy's side, ultimately. We're using one of the enemy's weapons there. To bait them with it, to get them to sin. And then as they get hooked into the sin, to take away more and more of the pleasure. Because we don't want them to feel good, all right? So that they end up damning themselves for things that they don't even enjoy anymore. They'll go to hell and say, as one man says, as Screwtape reports it, I see now that I had spent my whole life not only doing what I ought not to have done, but doing what I did not even like. The characteristic of life eventually is that it dampens the soul's capacity for ardent longing. This is paradoxical. It kills Eros. If it did not kill Eros, my gosh, our nation, which is just steeped in lust, would not now be billion-dollar consumers of little blue pills. Right? Or pornography. All of these things make the soul hard and cold, unable to love in truth, unable even to love in an old-fashioned, lustful, erotic way. So that, you know, if you actually see from old dramas, you know, as from Shakespeare, Romeo and Juliet, or something like that, you see two young people who are just madly in love with one another and enthralled. Okay, doing what they ought not to be doing because they're not married yet. All right? You see something much closer to the true good than what we have now. Consider steeped in lust and therefore finding it difficult even to understand old-fashioned lust, let alone love. What is it that the students now say they do when they're bored, which is most of the time because we produce people incapable of wonder? Thank you. A mechanical metaphor, not for beings made in the image and likeness of God, beings that should excite wonder, but for objects with plugs and sockets, hooking up. It just says it all. Yeah, steeped in lust, and therefore now not even capable of good old-fashioned lust, let alone love. Sorry.
Josh, that's on. I was also a student at Brockwood College.
You were a student at Brockwood
College? 30 years ago.
30 years.
Professor Jackson, I think.
Yeah, Art Jackson, yeah.
He offered a course called The Art of Wondering.
Yeah.
I didn't take it, but I...
Yes, sir, back there in the suit.
You mentioned the gladiatorial contest and how society had created in Roman society, and also, I can't remember the Carthage god that you...
Moloch.
Yeah. But it seems as though, from my limited knowledge, that the church... Christians in general at the time period were in opposition to those things, and if the church wasn't enabling those degradations, wasn't enabling those things. In today's society, it seems as though good parts of the church and good parts of our greater Christian community are selling tickets to the gladiatorial contests and are helping set up the contests.
I agree with you, but I bet you if you went back there, you'd find that there were a lot of Christians selling tickets. Mm-hmm. And Christians in the audience too.
You think so?
Yeah. Yeah. Isn't it always that way with men?
Yeah.
No. Man's a piece of work.
I mean, even when the Christians were being martyred in the Colosseum, I mean, you think that was happening?
But they had not been martyred in the arena since the time of Diocletian, before Constantine, immediately before Constantine. So, no, Christians are not being martyred in the arena, and yet the arena is still there. Now, a lot of people in the empire are not Christian, but the Christian emperors didn't do anything about it. Theodosius thought it would be a good thing to massacre Arian heretics in Thessalonica, for which he got himself nearly excommunicated by Ambrose in Milan. That was a good thing that Ambrose did. It would have been nice if Theodosius had shut down the games. Probably would have had riots and civil uprisings on their hands. They lived with it. There were a lot of lousy things that Christians have lived with. It doesn't redound to our credit. Okay. Well, I'll tell you what they didn't have then. They didn't have bishops making excuses for the gladiatorial games.
Right.
All right? That they didn't have.
Although they did later on.
Or priests. Was that?
In England, they lost a lot of bishops. John, there was only one good bishop in England when there was a test of bishops. Bishops haven't already always done the job they should do.
Two good bishops.
Two.
Oh, sorry. Oh, you're right. You're quite right. Only one. Only one. John Fisher.
I was going to say,
yes.
I heard someone remark recently that choice is so popular these days that men and women cannot make the choice to get married. They have so many choices that they never come. It used to be they didn't want to be forced to make a choice, whatever the choice was. And now they don't make the choice. They make the choice not to make the choice. And they go on living together for years and years, bring up children, and marriage is passé.
You know, am I right about this? I think that is ground zero, their choice, and it needs to be attacked directly. It occurred to me some years ago, I've said this to many people, that folks who are in favor of the abortion license would often criticize somebody like me and people like you as being anti-choice. And of course we would respond by saying, what are you talking about? This is ridiculous. We are opposed to the killing of human beings that are innocent, right? Little innocent babies in the womb, we are opposed to that. You can't just say we're opposed to choice. We need an object of that infinitive, right? It depends on what you're choosing. And then it comes to me, in a certain sense, yes, I am anti-choice, right? I have to be. Because as I mentioned some time before, about half an hour ago or so, the very finest things in human life come to us as gifts, and to the extent that we choose them, to that same extent we spoil them. All right? And if we think we constantly have to be at the helm, directing every little event with our little micro choices, we are going to be miserable people with whom nobody can really get along in a household. For instance, you marry. You have a very good chance of living happily with the person you have married. You stand the best chance of living happily with that person if you understand that this business about choice has just been tossed aside to the winds. People who say, I don't have any choice, are then freest to love their spouses, okay? And to grow into marriage with one another. And it's only people who retain some vestige of the choice who will always be looking for an escape clause, looking for a hatch, or saying to themselves, well, you know, maybe I made the wrong choice. Maybe I could choose something else in a couple of years to see how it works out. To do that is to kill yourself. It's to kill your marriage right there, okay? How can we ever devote ourselves entirely to anything? How can we ever exercise that virtue of devotion or loyalty unless we understand that there are things more important than our personal choices? Okay? For instance, I see this man upon the cross, and he has said to me, oh, I forgot, we're at a secular college. And he says to me, he who would save his life must lose it. And I understand now what that means. If I retain my fiction of control over my life, then I am trying to save it by my lights. But I will lose it that way. I will lose everything that's really best about this life here. Forget about the life to come. Okay? I won't even be a good neighbor. I won't be a good infantryman in the army. I won't be a good citizen. I won't be good to marry. I won't be good for anything. Because I'll still be wrapped up in my illusion of control. And then I'm going to die. All right? If I really want life and that in abundance, I've got to throw, ultimately, I've got to throw that choice to the winds. The most important things in life, oh yes, you make a choice, you marry. And then you make a choice never to have another choice again. Okay? And then you have, that's right, especially if your husband marrying a wife, right? And then you have a chance of actually being happy. This is a way of, so to speak, losing your life and gaining it 100-fold. The man who retains the illusion of choice, as he walking along with his buddies in the army, and a grenade is flung among them, will not do what the right thing to do is, the heroic thing. The heroic thing is to say, not to yourself, oh gee, I wonder if I should choose to save my buddies by throwing myself on that grenade. The choice to throw your choice away was made long ago when you entered the army. Then you can really have the virtue of devotion and fidelity that will overcome all fears. And you throw yourself upon the grenade because the relinquishing of your choice was made a long time ago. Because it's the right thing to do and you do it. And, you know, God bless us all at that moment. At that moment when you lose your life, you may be saving it for all eternity and saving the lives of your buddies. Do we have to send these good people home again? We take two more questions.
Well, it's up to you.
I'll take two more questions.
I don't want to wear you out.
I don't wear out. Yes.
What in the world do they do with these free chain of
conference? I don't. Well, I do know, actually. I went through one. Not much. They rely on stupid pop psychology. Okay? And then they give you an NFP presentation. Which is presented as a choice, yeah.
Well, isn't the choice that you do something and you can choose to do that?
In general, it's pretty bad. I'll tell you things that they don't do, okay? Things that would seem to be obvious. They don't talk to you about the beauty and wonder of children. They don't talk to you about the beauty and wonder of manhood. They don't talk to you about the beauty and wonder of womanhood. They don't talk to you about those passages in Scripture that have to do with how husbands and wives are supposed to get along with one another. They don't do that. They don't talk about the deep meaning of the marital act, what it has to do with creation and time and eternity. They don't do any of that. They don't take you back to the great mystical writers like John of the Cross and Teresa of Avila and all, and St. Bernard of Clairvaux, who see human sexuality in the context of the soul's yearning for union with God. They don't do any of that either, okay? They indulge in half-baked, second-rate pop psychology, as it seems to me, with a little overlay of NFP and the deep meaning of NFP. I don't know. One of my closest friends does NFP for pre-Cana conferences. Maybe, I have not seen him do it. Maybe he does it splendidly, okay? Introducing people to these things. My experience was that it was kind of pro forma, and it was interesting. It wasn't bad, but it was unrelated to all these other things. It was just there. Yes. Yeah, Catholics who don't manage to talk. Yes, ma'am.
I wondered, George Weigel had predicted that the theology of the body would cause a great revolution.
Yes.
And do you find at Providence College, the students, are they learning about the vision that Pope John Paul II gave in the theology of the body? Is that affecting their thinking at all?
That's an excellent question. I would say that there are four or five of the theology professors in the department who regularly or more or less regularly teach courses on marriage and on the theology of the body. Not to say that the others wouldn't. They've got other things to do. The theology department, excuse me, as a whole, is committed to that at the college. And I believe the Dominicans who are running the chaplain's office are also committed to it. I could wish there was more. On the other hand, there is quite a lot. Does it have an effect on the students? Yes. I see this indirectly. I mean, they come to me in my classes. I'm not teaching the theology of the body directly. I'm teaching Milton. And yet, when they talk to me about what Milton is doing with Adam and Eve in their papers, I see that they have already been presented with ideas that, you know, folks, for instance, at Harvard or at Holy Cross would never encounter in 50 years. It does have its effect. If I stand in front of a group of students now, and this would not have been true 20 years ago, or well, I've been there for 19 years, it would not have been true 15 years ago. But if I stand in front of a group of students now, and I talk about manhood and womanhood and virtue of purity, and the high view of marriage that we get, not just in Catholic writers, but in Edmund Spencer, the 16th century English Protestant writer, okay? Well, there might be one or two who resist it and resent it, but the great majority are happy to hear it. I don't know what effect that will have down the line for some of them. It had an immediate and powerful effect on at least a few of them, and probably more, but at least a few of them I know because they talked to me. So there's reason, there's all kinds of reason for hope there. I believe that Weigel is right. I believe that John Paul's theology of the body is still in acorn stage. Okay? I mean, we have only started to apply it to moral questions regarding sexual intercourse. We've not even begun to apply it to what does it mean to be a man? What does it mean to be a woman? That hasn't even begun. What does it mean to possess a body rather than be a disembodied spirit? This will be fruitful for the next 400 or 500 years at least. And you can add into that mix the boss's recent statement, Benedict, that love is also a fundamental principle of being. Okay? This will be as revolutionary as Thomas Aquinas' formulation was, that God is the being, the only being, who possesses his existence necessarily. That is, it is his essence to exist. Okay? That changed metaphysics, changed the history of philosophy, changed theology. It's a watershed event in the history of human thought. I think that we've got two watersheds right here in our own lifetimes. We're not even going to begin to see the effects of these, but these are things that will play out in coming centuries. Okay? Love is also a fundamental principle. It's an amazing and daring assertion and correct. But boy, I mean, it has all kinds of implications too, I would imagine. Thank you, guys.
Thank you all for coming.
know.
I just asked you.
How are you?
Yep. Is this snazzy? It actually holds